the leaders who really prove to their team that they're invested in that person, those are the leaders that we remember. Those are the leaders that we listen to. Those are the leaders that we fight for. And those are the teams that we don't want to leave. So I think it's less about inclusion and like, how do we make sure everyone's feeling included? And it's more about, man, how do you really prove to your team that you care about them? And hopefully create a space where they care about each other. Because if that happens, inclusion just becomes the norm.
This is Bridging the Gap with your host, Matt Reiner.
Stephen Van Cohen, welcome to Bridging the Gap, my friend. How are you?
It's going well, my friend. How are you?
I'm doing well. As we were talking, we were fortunate to have your co-author, Ryan Jenkins, on the podcast recently and really enjoyed that conversation and just really excited to dig into the book and all the work y'all have done even deeper with you. So just super appreciative of you joining us. And we're going to, you know, with Ryan, we talked a lot about loneliness and the psychology around loneliness. And me and him were worried about whether the podcast would be too negative talking about loneliness. But it was actually very inspirational and uplifting. So today, I think we'll talk a little bit about loneliness, but move on to kind of inclusion and a lot of the work y'all have done there. But before we do, I always like to get to know the guests a little bit better. And yeah, you know, I'm just curious. Yeah, you know, you're doing a lot on the organizational culture side of organizations, and you've worked with a lot of big companies. You've done a lot on psychology and loneliness and inclusion. But what did the 13-year-old Stephen Van Cohen want to be when he grew up?
Probably a professional soccer player. So like when I was 13, I was the 13-year-old who hit puberty like way before everyone else. So I was 6 feet tall, 130 pounds, and I was all into sports. So basketball and soccer were my two go-tos. And 13-year-old Steve probably would have said professional soccer player. But by 17-year-old Steve, I realized I'm not that good. And my pipe dream of being a professional soccer player went right out the window.
No, that's like me. I mean, I had dreams of being a professional baseball player when I was 13. And then I realized when I was riding the bench as the water boy, that that's not a really good path to being a professional baseball player. So those dreams were shattered really early. And you know, it's better to get it out of the way early on than too late. Well, then tell us about kind of that journey from wanting to be a professional soccer player at 13, realizing maybe at 17 that the skills weren't there, to now to the work that you're doing today.
Yeah. I had this really cool experience when I was, I think, probably right around the 13 age range, maybe 12 to 14, where none of my youngest brothers' moms and dads wanted to be their soccer coach. So I was super into soccer, played competitive travel soccer. My six-year-old brother at the time was getting into Park District soccer. None of the parents wanted to coach. And my dad said, "Do you want to be the coach for your brother David's soccer team?" So as a 13-year-old, I was every week coaching these like 6 or 7-year-old Park District boys, and I loved every second of coaching. I loved teaching, training, guiding, being on the sideline during the games, and there was something about that experience that really grabbed me. And when I got into college and figured out a degree and wanted to kind of think about life after school, the learning and development, the coaching, the leadership, like all of that stuff really resonated with me. And I was really lucky. I graduated from the University of Illinois and I got a first job for a startup. And most startups, they throw people into positions that they're totally unqualified to lead. And I led the HR onboarding, training, and supervisory development functions for a startup. And as a 23-year-old doing that work, I was hooked, and it's been my career ever since then.
As you've kind of evolved, when you started out in that, the startup and the HR side and helping with the team there, and then what you know now, like what are some of those things that you would have loved to have known back in those early days that you can only really get from experience these days?
So when I got my first what I would call like big boy job, so I got my first internal consulting job as a 25-year-old. And for context, I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago. So, you know, I'm a Midwesterner, born and bred. And I got a job as an internal consultant working for the world's largest gold mining company. And coming from Chicago, going to work for the world's largest gold mining company, that's like a super massive stretch because there's no mining and it's not something that I had any exposure to. And I got hired as an internal consultant to design and deliver a bunch of leadership initiatives for like 1,000 frontline supervisors across these operations. And as a 25-year-old, training a bunch of 50-year-olds with no mining experience and not a whole lot of professional life experience, I learned really quickly that I could not lean on what I thought I knew or the research I read or the books that I studied. Like, I had to come in very humble and I had to lean on a lot of the knowledge of the people I was training and then find little pockets of opportunities to try to teach and coach and provide some context to. Whereas I'm a very enthusiastic, high energy, kind of, you know, bold, confident guy. And I went in guns blazing too early. And it required me to take a step back and be like, all right, I don't know all the things I think I know. I got to really be a lot more humble in how I'm coaching and teaching and training. And by learning that early on and leaning into that, it made a huge difference with the work I did with those clients. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that it's always interesting when we're young and naive and we get into a profession, we think we have to prove ourselves. And sometimes it's just a matter of the best thing to do is just to observe and to be kind of a fly on the wall and do your work and observe, and you prove through action as opposed to through knowledge and saying. And we get that kind of feeling from school, where, you know, the best students are the ones that are always talking and answering questions and the teachers are appreciating them. So we try to convert that over. And I feel that there's like, I'm curious from your perspective, because you've done so much work with developing organizational cultures and everything of that nature, the challenges that young people have getting into the workforce. And yeah, I think about it from that standpoint of, hey, I have to speak up to be seen, to show value, and also that there's a right and a wrong way of doing it. I pass or I fail. And so there is like this like mentality. And I'm curious kind of how you see that inside of the organizations. And I'm also curious just how organizations can help younger and team members overcome that, because it is such an ingrained thing. You go through that for 18, 21 years, and it's hard to overcome that for so long.
I mean, that's a big question that we could talk a lot about, right? So like the first part of your question of what would you recommend to a young professional, especially one who comes in with a lot of confidence and a lot to prove, quote unquote, is one of my clients, we were developing some learning initiatives for them. And part of their onboarding, one of the best practices was this idea of being a hungry learner. And I always liked that line. And I think you could still have a lot to say and you can prove your moxie, but if you're a hungry learner and you're really interested in listening and understanding and absorbing, then it'll probably balance each other out. To your question about what can organizations do in order to help, especially their young professionals thrive who might be coming in with a lot to prove, is to create opportunities to fail safe. I think what happens is too many leaders and too many companies, they put way too many guardrails around their employees, especially their young employees, which is a real bummer because we learn most through mistakes. We learn most through trial and error. We learn most through kind of dipping our toes in and getting some response back. And when we are so bubble wrapped at work and we're not allowed to do anything because there's really specific procedures and it's been done 100 times, so there's no other way to do it, it really prevents deep, meaningful learning from happening because I'm just doing what I'm told versus experimenting, which is really good for me, especially as a young professional. So those would be a couple of things that I would consider if I'm a leader in an organization thinking about what to do with some young professionals joining my team.
I think that's incredible. And I love the idea of being a hungry learner. I think that that is something of like kind of staying curious is the mentality and being open-minded, right? It's not a matter of knowing the answers. It's a matter of being able to go through the process of figuring out the best answer for that particular situation. And I want to get into this idea of creating opportunities to fail safe, which I think kind of delves into psychological safety. I want to come back to that here in a second, but I know that Ryan and I, we spend a lot of time on loneliness, but I want to kind of bring some of that into this conversation before we get into inclusion. Is a lot of what we talk about is in the book and a lot of the materials is that loneliness is a real thing within the workforce. I think that the definition and the perspective, and Ryan and I talked about this a good bit, is what is loneliness, right? I think we perceive it as being something that you can see, but I think that companies fail to see it. And I'm curious from your perspective, you know, as a leader of an organization that's listening to this podcast or a leader of a team, what are signs of employee loneliness, right? What can they identify that they may just be blind to right now because you're lonely, like you'd be in a in a room by yourself. That's what lonely means, which is not true necessarily.
Yeah, I think the word is a weird word, especially to be used in the context of work. Loneliness is a really charged word that has a very strong emotional state tied to it. And unfortunately, when people think of the word lonely, they think of people who are like just unlovable, people who are antisocial, people who are hermits, who don't want to have any exposure to any humans. And they're kind of like denounced to be by themselves forever. And they are incapable of making quality friendships. Like that's, I think, the paradigm that many have when we think about loneliness. But that's not the case. Loneliness is essentially this feeling where I'm not satisfied with the quality of my connections with those around me. And when we talk to leaders and organizations around the world, we tend to not use the word loneliness because it's such a weird word. We tend to use the word socially disconnected. And that term seems to resonate because most leaders can come to grips with the fact that, yeah, we're not as connected as we could be. Our relationships are not as strong as we probably want them to be. And there's often cracks in the dynamic of the team that feeling more closely connected to one another would fill. So at work, if I'm a leader and I have a group of team members and I want to pinpoint who might be feeling socially disconnected, a couple of things that I'm going to pay attention to. One is how open and honest are people when we're in meetings? Are people participating and showing up? And do they have a vibrant disposition or are they just going through the motions? Are people's cameras off more commonly than they're on? And I know being on Zoom all day long is exhausting, but there is a very big difference between cameras off and cameras on. Are people making a lot of mistakes with their work? Because if they're making mistakes, they might not care. And if they don't care, it's probably because relationships within their group are not strong enough to where I'm willing to go above and beyond to do really exceptional work. And am I just getting the sense that people on my team are just not all in, right? Like there's a lot of research and data that shows when people on team really care about each other, they really are close. They are embedded on a foundation of trust and they feel like they can show up as the true version of themselves without a whole lot of worry on how people are going to react to them. Like when those conditions are met, you can just tell. Team members show up in a different headspace and they are able to contribute in a different way. So I would just be paying a little bit more attention to like the dynamics of the team and how are we really interacting. And by examining some of those behaviors, I might start to get some clues to feel like, you know what, we're not as connected as we should be. And what do we do about it? I'm sure we'll talk about that as we get into our podcast.
Yeah. And I'm curious is that, so, you know, let's take that. And this may lead us into our next topic of inclusion as well. But so as a leader, I'm becoming more aware of my people, right? I'm spotting these things, but now I'm becoming more aware of them, like camera off or someone's just being more reserved, or they're just kind of saying what they think everybody wants to say in meetings, whatever it may be. I have identified that. Now, the question is what do I do to act upon that? I can't just tell them, hey, we really appreciate it maybe, but like, what is the action step that I go about now that I've identified that? And I can't go up to them and say, hey, I feel like you're socially disconnected, right? So what does that look like? Or you seem lonely. Yeah. Like you can't really say that effective. So what would be some of those actions that a quality leader would then take once they've observed these things?
Yeah, well, I'll reinforce, Matt, that like going up to team members to say, you look really lonely. Do you want to talk about your loneliness? That's a no-go. Like that's a hard pass. Do not do that. So in this like model that Ryan and I developed in our book, there's essentially four parts. The first part is looking for loneliness. We've talked about that, right? We say awareness is curative. Like unless you're really aware of what's going on, super hard to put any kind of, you know, controls or fixes in place. The second part is to what we call invest in connection. And we use the word invest very intentionally because what happens is oftentimes leaders think, I just need to do a happy hour. I just need to do like a team offsite. I just need to do like a 10-minute icebreaker once a month. And I'm doing the things that are going to make us feel more strongly connected. And that's just not how it works, right? Like, you don't do one thing one time and all of a sudden have these really robust, meaningful connections with each other. The word investment means that we have to make a commitment and find real, like tangible time to invest in the dynamic of the group. So sometimes leaders will use the investment period to do team check-ins. And a team check-in is when everyone gives a score from A to F. A is really good, F's really bad. And by going around and saying, you know, right now this week I'm a B and here's the reasons why. Or for me, it's a C and here's the reasons why. Like taking dedicated time just to understand where everyone's at on the team and what's working and what's not, and checking in and providing support and guidance and helpfulness, that's really connective. So that's like an investment in an activity that we do on a cadence. Another way is by making sure that there's really clear directions and people really know where they're going. Because if I'm feeling lost at work and I don't know who to turn to, I don't know the destination, I'm feeling overwhelmed and I don't feel supported, you're going to feel pretty lonely. And it's going to be hard for you to reach out to those who can get you back pulled into the fray. So finding ways to make sure that the team is really clear on their direction. Making people feel significant is another investment. Like one of the quickest ways to build a connection with someone is to take time to make them feel valuable, needed, desired, important, right? And by doing some of the types of exercises where we celebrate each other, we provide team positive recognition, I write letters to people so they know how meaningful to the group. Like those are all investments, right? Like I'm making dedicated time to do the types of activities that are really good for our group's dynamic. The problem is the time that I dedicate to actually do this with my team tends to be very far down the to-do list. And I don't think it's as important as the other things I have to do. So we're not investing in it. So what you do to make your group really feel closely tied to one another, there's a whole bunch of things you can do.
So it's really about like an allocation of your resources. It's an allocation of your time. And if dedicated a small amount of time to team and team connectivity, then you're going to get lower value add or output from that standpoint. Now, you know, the question I do have, that as you were talking about the investment in the team, and one of the things you mentioned was like this check-in of how you are, where you are. I think about it like your battery level. We do that in our leadership meetings and offsites. It's like, where's your charge? Are you, you know, 30% or 100%, or and then why? And within a leadership team, we can be vulnerable, right? That's part of our structure. The challenge gets to, as you go down, sometimes employees, like the vulnerability of this is they don't want to expose weakness to their manager, especially if that manager is like a partner or a very senior level person. And so I'm curious of what you've seen to be successful to help overcome that. And I guess it comes to a comfort and a inclusion aspect, but where does that sit to help team members not feel like if they say F, because like I have some family stuff, that they're going to be like reprimanded at that point, right?
Yeah. I mean, the only way to get people comfortable doing that is if the most senior influential person is doing it first, right? Like if I'm the senior leader, I have to have F days or F weeks, and I have to be able to explain why I'm feeling the way I'm feeling. And if I'm willing to do that and share, it doesn't need to be like, let's open the closet and talk about all of our deepest, darkest secrets. Like, let's not expose every little family dynamic that's going on in our life and share it with the team. You know, it could be as simple as saying like, man, I just don't know what to do. Or, hey, I'm really unsure about this. Or, you know what, guys, that wasn't the right move. I thought it was and it wasn't. And I'm sorry for, you know, putting you through that. Whatever it is, those are all opportunities to show people that you don't have to be superhuman all the time, right? The other thing that leaders can do that I found to be really helpful, and it's not something most leaders are good at, but it's to extend an arm to team members and ask for help. Like there's something really connective. Mm. If I can go to you and be like, Matt, I don't know what I'm doing right now. Like you're really good at this. I need advice. I need guidance. I need perspective. And when leaders can do that and just ask for any kind of help or assistance or perspective, that goes a long way in being able to prove to the team that you don't have to have all the answers all the time. But it's up to the leader, right? I always tell the leaders I work with and coach, people won't do what you say, they'll do what you do. Like they are paying attention to every little thing you do. And if you're not doing the things you want them to do, then they're not going to, because you are the one that is driving everything from a dynamic standpoint. And when leaders start to understand that, it can be a way more intentional about like what they're doing and how they're doing it, that's when leaders start to see pretty exciting changes within their group.
Yeah, I love the idea of the leading by example, being vulnerable yourself. You have to show that you are human. I think sometimes leaders think they have to put on this image of strength, and strength being that you can't show your weakness. And I think that's actually, you know, I've always said, you know, in emotional contexts as well, is that strength isn't not showing weakness or emotion, but rather not letting the weaknesses or the emotions drive your next action, right? It's a matter of saying, hey, this is how I am, but I'm aware of how I am, and I'm not going to let that determine what I do next. And I think that's a sense of strength in that sense. But I think it also comes back to something that you talk a lot about, which is psychological safety. And it's something that I've talked a lot about in a lot of content that I've written, is creating psychological safety. And I'm curious from your perspective, what is psychological safety and how do you go about building psychological safety in an organization? I think would be a really good starting point.
Yeah, when it comes to the idea of psychological safety, it's really rooted in this idea that people can show up and feel that there's no fear of like repercussion. Like I can say what I need to say openly and I trust the responses of my team members to be such that are going to be, you know, positive in nature. Now, they might not agree with me and they might challenge my idea, but the sentiment is going to be positive in nature. And all of psychological safety is built on this idea that the team members have a strong level of trust. And my favorite example of how trust is built comes from Brené Brown. And she has this really cool little story about what she calls the marble jar. And the marble jar is this idea that within the relationships that we have with others, every single time that we do something really small that is trust building, it's essentially a marble going into a jar, right? And in order for me and you to have a lot of trust, there's a lot of little moments that I have to do compounding over time to get this marble jar all the way filled up. But like any good analogy, it takes a long time with all these little moments to be, you know, conjured up. One big moment where I knocked that jar over and all of a sudden, boom, like those marbles are all over the floor and we're back to square one. And from a team dynamic standpoint, every little thing that team members do and every little thing that the leaders do are either putting marbles in or taking marbles out of the jar. And I've spent so much time in team meetings, watching the dynamic of the group, watching the leader, how he or she is facilitating so I could provide feedback and coaching and context. And there are so many little things that happen that people are totally unaware of. A roll of the eyes when I say something, right? Like marbles are being removed. A leader stopping someone before they're finished talking, that's a marble being removed. So psychological safety is when the teams are really hyper aware of the level of trust and how that is showing up in a group. And what the research has found is really like the two most important requirements for psychological safety, which seems super straightforward. They're not, because it's harder to do than one would think. But the two components are what's called ostentatious listening, meaning that the team members are really listening. Like they're not distracted, they're all in. Like you get the sense that when you share in a meeting, people are really interested in what you have to say and they're giving your perspective quite a bit of thought. And then the second is what they call equal participation, meaning that in meetings, it's not driven by one or two people, that there's like a pretty equal dispersion among the attendees where everyone's able to share and get some perspective out on the table. When those elements are in place, right, ostentatious listening, everyone's participating and we're aware of how we're treating each other in the meeting, all of that starts to build upon psychological safety, which according to like the largest meta-analysis Google has ever done within their teams, has been proven to be the single greatest correlate to a team's success. So lots to unpack there, but I'll stop there for now, Matt.
So I want to take this even further and talk a little bit deeper about inclusion. And because inclusion, you know, I think that you mentioned it or it was in the book, is this idea where people can come to work and feel comfortable and confident to be themselves and work in a way that suits them, right? And still deliver on the business needs. And to me, that sounds like having autonomy and comfort, right? Which is what we're talking about with psychological safety, that you feel comfortable. And I think we talked about this a little bit of like companies need to create an ability that it's comfortable or okay to fail, right? And I think that that leads into psychological safety. But a lot of leaders, as you grow your firm, they need to, they put together processes and structure and et cetera. And so I'm curious to how you find that balance or what that equivalent or that utopian balance is inside of an organization that creates this opportunity for autonomy, but also doesn't create a rogue environment that everybody's doing it a different way because they all work differently, but it's still aligned towards the business goal. So I think that seems like a big challenge, and companies, I think, move that pendulum way to one side too often. And I'm curious kind of how you see that balance.
Well, first I would say, I don't think there's such thing as a utopian environment, right? Like, I don't think that exists. I also don't think when we get into the context of work that people should be going to work in a utopian environment, because work is work, right? Like, when Ryan and I profiled a lot of businesses for our book, there was a really strong balance between a workplace that invests in people and cares for people and takes time for the relationships and is really good about creating a culture where people come first. And then there's a balance between companies who really care about productivity and efficiency and being the best and, you know, doing the stuff that they do. It can't be all in on one or the other, right? So to just clarify, I think it can't be this like utopian environment where everyone's just having the best time with one another and there's just all the focus on inclusion and people. Like, work still has to get done and we have to be mindful of that. The way that I think about inclusion, and it's not so much from like a DE&I standpoint, what I think about from an inclusion standpoint, especially when I work with leaders, is finding ways for the leader to show their people that they care about them, like really care about them. Like, I don't just care that you do a good job because you have to as a part of your job performance, but like, I really care about you as a human being that I'm in charge of, you know, in this role at this organization. And what I've come to learn over the 15 years I've been working with leaders from all over the world, the leaders who really do care, like a lot above and beyond just wanting to check box as being a thoughtful and inclusive leader, but the leaders who really prove to their team that they're invested in that person, those are the leaders that we remember. Those are the leaders that we listen to. Those are the leaders that we fight for. And those are the teams that we don't want to leave. So I think it's less about inclusion and like, how do we make sure everyone's feeling the same and included? And it's more about, man, how do you really prove to your team that you care about them and hopefully create a space where they care about each other? Because if that happens, inclusion just becomes the norm.
When I think about, you know, some of the best leaders, and I think as you grow, your organization becomes more difficult, but some of the most impactful leaders, at least in my life, were people that, you know, you felt was your dad or your mom or your brother or your sister, and like, not like in a, you know, familial way, but it just felt like they truly honestly cared. It wasn't like it wasn't a structured process. It was natural, it was authentic, and it was truly like deeply passionate about the person themselves. And so then where it gets to is, I imagine it's different at a 10-person firm than it is at a 50-person firm, at a 5,000-person firm. And I guess it starts from the top, right? And the leader needs to be passionate with and really truly understand the people that are on the leadership team. And then that drives the leadership team down to the management team. And it kind of is this waterfall effect. But I'm curious, like, how organizations can measure the effectiveness of it, because I can see that it's easy to measure at maybe 10, 50, 100 people, but it becomes really difficult to measure and understand at 500,000, et cetera, as you continue to grow and become bigger. I mean, I just think about us. We've grown from 32 people to 100 people in the span of 2.5 years. Like, it becomes really difficult. I used to know everybody and everybody's kids and what babies were being born. Now it's like, yeah, I'm struggling to understand everybody's names. Like, there's only so much I can remember. And so, yeah, it becomes difficult. I'm just curious, and this is more of a selfish question because, you know, we're dealing with this right now.
Well, it's an awesome question, and you solved your own problem, right? You said, is it a cascading effect where me as the most senior person in the room, am I proving to people that this matters, and am I demonstrating to people how I think some of this stuff should be done? And if that's the case, then it will be adopted and it'll become a part of the culture and you'll see other people do it. Not because they feel like they have to, but because it's just the way we do business here, right? Measuring it becomes a bit more tricky, but it's very doable. Like during the pandemic, one of our clients is a client named Physicians Endoscopy, and they have like 800 GI doctor offices across the country. So they're a really big healthcare provider for gastrointestinal doctors and services. And they have like, I think 2,500 people who work for them. And during the pandemic, you know, like every other company, they went fully remote and they're trying to figure out how do we create really meaningful connection while everyone's kind of in this hyper vigilant state of not wanting to be together. So what they did is they created this like almost like a multi-level marketing scheme where like the most senior leaders had six people that they had to do these activities with. And the activities, I think, were once a month for an hour for 6 months. And with each of the people that they had under their tree, they had to go through a series of just like non-work related, get to know you / you know, belonging boosting types of questions. And during those sessions, the senior leaders really focused on questions that are really good for, you know, bonding and belongingness. And then those six people who were with their leader then had six people, and they had six people, and they did this throughout the entire organization. And they had different people paired with one another answering these questions once a month for 60 minutes. And what happened is people started to feel such a strong sense of belonging and connection that all of a sudden the 1 hour all hands, people requested, we want like half day all hands. And the check-ins that people were doing, all of a sudden they wanted a 2XL. And when they saw their retention numbers, their retention went up 30%. And when they saw their sick day numbers, it went down by 50%. Like they didn't measure it explicitly, but there was a pretty strong correlation between doing this thing and actually seeing just a whole bunch of impactful outcomes that were tied back to it. So I think if a company and if leaders are willing to just invest in doing some of that stuff, you'll feel the measurement without necessarily having to formally measure it, if that makes sense.
I love that idea. I mean, that's such a, and it's such an easy to implement way of doing it. And it creates a realness of the company and the people in the company. And I think that that's what it's all about. And, you know, it also leads into something that I saw you talk about in when your TEDx that you did at Northwestern, I believe it was. And you and Ryan both have said it, this idea that communication is dealt, connection is felt, right? You can't just say you want this or put up all these core values on your wall and say that you should connect with your teammates, right? Like you got to have that connection. But then you talked about some of these prolific, you know, podcasters and interviewers like Joe Rogan, Oprah Winfrey, Adam Grant, who are able to effectively connect with their guests. I'm curious, can you share how they are so good, what they do to create connection with these people that they've never met, which is even harder than what we're doing inside of an organization?
Yeah, the biggest difference is its intentionality. There's this really awesome clip. So if anybody's interested in the difference between communication and connection, all you got to do is go on YouTube and search Oprah Makes James Corden Cry. And if you watch that 90-second clip, in 90 seconds, Oprah does these seven really subtle things that pull the emotions out of James. And in this 90 seconds, there's all these subtle, like really specific things that she gets into, and we can talk about them if you want. But the main thing she does is she is fully focused. She is giving you such undivided attention that it makes you feel seen, right? I talk about loneliness is being seen through, belonging is being seen as. It's like, you are in this moment with me and I get that reassurance that you care. You really want to know what I have to say. You're really listening. You're asking me the types of questions that give me validation that you want to know more. You're like synthesizing what I'm saying in a way to prove back to me that we're in sync and you get it. Those are the types of things, they're called pro-social behaviors. It's all the little tiny things that make me feel empathized with, understood, interested in, that when we do those intentionally, people feel connected. When we're just transactionally communicating all day long, different, right? We need to communicate to figure out who's doing what, by when, where, and how. Not going to make me feel like you care about me or that you're interested in me, or we're not going to forge that moment. And it's interesting because feeling connected to someone can happen in as little as 40 seconds. but then intentionality has to be there. Like, I have a 2-year-old and I'm really biased, but I'm pretty confident. My 2-year-old is really cute. So whenever we go anywhere and anybody says, oh my God, your daughter is just so beautiful, how connected do you think I feel to that person? Total stranger, will never see them again, maybe 5 to 10 seconds worth of interaction. They made me feel amazing, right? And like in that moment, I feel connected to them. But like that type of stuff doesn't just happen when I'm busy and my hair is on fire and I'm going from meeting to meeting to meeting. I have to find ways to actually like create those moments with the people around me. And that's the difference. And I think that's some of the secret sauce to how we actually do it.
I mean, I could have you on for hours. I mean, we could turn this into a Tim Ferriss podcast. I think I told that to Ryan as well. I mean, we could make this into a 4-hour podcast because I got so many questions, but I do want to be cognizant of your time. And before I get into kind of my wrap-up questions, I am just curious. To leaders that say, I want to be that. Like, I know that I have maybe a blind spot where I'm not in tune with my people. I'm really business-focused. I'm very intentional, but it's more on like, hey, I'm structured. What are some tips you can give them that say, hey, this is how you can be more Oprah or more Adam Grant or more Joe Rogan to some extent? You know, what are some tips of how they can be more of that?
Yeah. The number one universal tip that has worked so tremendously well that I literally recommend it to every single leader that I work with is this idea that comes from Marcus Buckingham. So Marcus Buckingham, when he was at Gallup, did in all these research studies and projects. And one of the ones he did was on feedback. And they found at Gallup that 10-minute informal weekly check-ins, one-on-one from a leader to a subordinate, was one of the strongest correlations between retention and performance. So they found that engagement increased by 77% and retention increased by 66% when leaders had these informal one-on-one check-ins. And it's super straightforward. Like, what are you up to this week? How are things going? What can I do to help you? Where are you facing troubles, right? Like a couple of just quick open-ended questions. But by having that dedicated time one-on-one each week, it just creates the opportunity for me to be more intentional with how I connect, how I give you feedback, how I give you positive reinforcement, how I direct you. And it's one of those things where it might seem like a huge time suck, depending on how many people you have. 10 minutes once a week can seem overwhelming. But during those sessions, you mitigate failures, you cut down on mistakes, you make people feel included, you show you care, you provide positive reinforcement, you get really important information from the team member that you might not have gotten if you didn't have those sessions. And it's a real investment, but it's one of the best investments you can make. And I've had hundreds of leaders commit to that. And the feedback I've gotten is so overwhelmingly positive that it's a no-brainer for most people to do.
It reminds me of the advice that you hear so often of leaders. They should just be walking. They should be walking around the office and just stopping in, right? And making it authentic and organic. And you're just checking in, but you're being intentional on that, but you're being authentic and connected on the actual communication, I think is.
Well, Matt, there's one quick difference. There's one quick difference. If I'm walking around, all of a sudden I'm interrupting you. And that interruption might come off as being really unnecessary, distracting, and annoying. If I had scheduled 10-minute check-ins where like every Tuesday, you know, from 8 to 8:15, that's our time to check in, it's totally different. Because now I come into that engagement with you ready to talk. I've thought about what I want to share. Like we're actually having a much more productive session versus me just bumping into you kind of ad hoc throughout the day.
I love that. Everybody says you just walk around, but then how that's been perceived by being interrupted can be actually a backfire negative to the connection that you're trying to make. And so I think that that's a really great call out. Steven, man, I can have you on we could talk for days. I didn't even get through half my questions because, you know, we just dug into some of these really deep things, which is awesome. You know, before I let you go, I always like to learn more about my guests by, you know, and learn from them because I try to bring on selfishly people that are smarter than me so I can learn from them. And I like to learn through reading as well. And so I'm always curious, what's a book out there outside of your book, which I know everybody should go get, we'll put the link in the notes, but that you think that everybody should read or reread if they've already read it once?
Yeah, the book that I've been obsessed with lately is a book called Influence is Your Superpower. And the author, her name is Zoe Chance. She's a professor at Yale, and she used to be the chief marketing officer at Barbie. And she does a really phenomenal job of talking about how to influence others without it feeling too prescriptive or persuasive or salesy. And I love a lot of what she talks about in that book. So Influence is Your Superpower is a must read, in my opinion.
Love that. All right, last question. We talked about a lot, but if you could give the listeners one piece of actionable advice to walk away with, to incorporate in their daily life or their professional life right now, what would that be?
It would be to make time intentionally to invest in the connections around you. Just like you make time to work out and you take time to eat dinner, like you need to carve out very tactical and tangible time to actually connect in the right ways, or else busyness will get the best of you and you'll continue to feel a bit disconnected.
It's incredible, man. I really appreciate this time. I can't wait to continue to stay in touch and follow your journey and learn from you. And I know that many people on the podcast will want to do the same. So what's the best way for people to stay in touch, get in touch, and continue to follow everything you're doing?
Yeah. So best way is to find me on LinkedIn, Stephen Van Cohen. I'm pretty easy to find. And then it sounds like a dating website. It's not, but you can go to lesslonely.com. Lesslonely.com is our hub for like all things book and connection and social capital. And I promise you're not going to get spammed and or a virus, because it's not like a dating site. It's a legit place to go to learn about the work we're doing.
Stephen, man, I appreciate you and look forward to having you back on the pod here soon. But again, thanks for your time and for your insights, and stay well, be well. And we will talk again very soon, my friend.
Thanks, Matt.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Bridging the Gap. Don't forget to give us a rating and let us know what you think.